There is a secret that most pro athletes, elite CEOs, and high performers all know. They all have a group of world-class coaches working for them to help them optimize their potential. At Super Athlete Radio, our goal is to provide you with the caliber of world-class coaches and guests to help you unlock your potential, dominate your industry, and dominate your life. Let's get better today. Welcome to Super Athlete Radio, where I am really excited to bring on legendary athletic performance coach Vern Gambata onto the show today. Vern is an absolute legend in the athletic performance industry. He's been doing it for over 50 years, and he shares so much wisdom with us in terms of talent development, training, recovery, mindset. Just an amazing human being, and it's an amazing episode. I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. Let's get into it. Mr. Gambata, really excited to have you on Super Athlete Radio. How are you today?
I'm doing well. In the midst of a move, see behind me, used to be filled with books and all kinds of stuff, and we're two and a half weeks from moving back to California finally after many, many years. So exciting. Yeah. You know.
That is exciting. And you know, we all want to live a great life, and it sounds like in the fourth quarter of yours being able to buy a house across the street from your daughter and grandkid is I love that move.
Doesn't get much better than that, does it? So if you want to, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And San Francisco, special place, special energy, you know, went to coach at Cal, went to grad school at Stanford, and got a lot of friends, a lot of professional colleagues out there, you know, so I'm really excited. It's crazy. You don't usually do these things, as you said, in the fourth quarter of your life. You know, you usually do them in the third quarter.
And then right before we got on, you talked. I mentioned about my history in track with a few of my mentors who are very high level track coaches, and you said that you can't go wrong with having a foundation in track. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so thankful. I played football in college, and I just wasn't quite good enough to do anything with it, and it interfered with spring practice back in the days. You know, I played in the days when we didn't wear helmets, and you know, dinosaurs were roaming the earth and that. But I learned so much training with the track guys, okay, particularly with the jumpers. And then I competed in track decathlon after college. And it has been run, jump, and throw is the foundation of everything we do. You know, the locomotor skills, the things that you learn, and the eye that you develop in coaching track has stood me well across a huge spectrum of sports, you know. And so I tell all the young people, if you can, hang out with a track coach. Learn the events, learn the, you know, all the events, and you don't have to be proficient in them. But I had my senior year in college, I had a class called Theory of Track and Field, and we had to show proficiency in all the events, and you were graded. Boy, you know, what a wake up call about learning body athleticism, body position, all the things that, you know, I espouse today really come from that. And you know, so yeah, that's the foundation of everything we do, going back thousands of years too, you know.
And then what led you into doing the decathlon after college?
Well, I didn't want to coach football. I really liked basketball, but I got really turned on to coaching track. And one of my mentors, Red Estes, who was the assistant track coach at Fresno State, said, "Well, you'll go back to Santa Barbara. There's an active decathlon colony there. Why don't you just try to compete in a decathlon?" And to learn all events. I mean, what better way to learn? And what a fortuitous thing. I mean, you don't usually start an event like decathlon when you're 21 years old. And I knew I got to train with world record holders. You know, I was nowhere near their caliber, but the beauty of decathlon and the beauty of track and field is there's camaraderie, you know, and people understood that if I was willing to do the work, they would indulge me, you know, and answer my stupid questions and learn. And then we had a lot of Europeans, particularly Germans, come to Santa Barbara to train. Mm. And watching them and watching what they did and how they approached strength training, I'm just working on the chapter of my new book, reworking the chapter of my new book, was an eye-opener to me. We'd go in the weight room and spend 2 hours and grunt and groan and lift really heavy. And they'd come in for 20 minutes and do three sets of three snatches and some jump squats and maybe one other exercise and go back out in the track and throw and jump and, you know, do their event. And they were explosive and powerful, and we were big and strong and basically slow, you know, is what happened. And boy, was that was an eye-opener for me. That was like my third or fourth year coaching and my second year training. And I mean, I could bench a house and squat the Empire State Building and that, but it helped me be better, but it wasn't that kind of athleticism, that kind of explosiveness that I saw as a result of what I saw those Europeans do in the weight room. Yeah. Or not do. That's too.
Yeah. And then on that same topic, when I think of the decathlon and then kind of what you just said with the Germans who came in and their way of training, with a lot of the elite athletes that we coach, it's a matter many times of them doing too much. And then also with the entrepreneurs and the executives in our programs, again, it's a matter of not being finding ways to turn off so they can fully turn on. Could you talk a little bit about the importance of
fully turn on?
Yeah, right? Because most people they don't fully turn off, so then they're not able to fully turn on, right? So do you have any specific thoughts on energy management and what's the best way for people to kind of look at that?
I mean, you know, again, going through the years, I'm an octogenarian now, 77. When I started coaching, I was teaching a full load of classes first in history and then PE after the first year. I worked out in the morning. I worked out between classes. I coached at my school, and then I coached at a high school. Married, no kids at that time. And somebody said, "Well, you were tired all the time." And I go, "Not really. I was energized. I was energized. I mean, you know, you couldn't help but you're working with kids. You see their improvement. You're a novice in your sport. You see your improvement." So it's directing and managing energy, and it's really a mental approach, isn't it? I mean, I can talk you into being tired right now, Chase. You know, if you want to, you know, and I'm fortunate right now working with a young lady, Summer McIntosh, who holds the world record in the 400 IM, and she's working her butt off, and every day she comes wants more. You know, and I talked to her a lot, and I got to know her, particularly her mom's down here. She's Canadian. Her dad's up there. And it's an outlook. It's a mindset, you know, that energy yields energy, you know, and you learn to manage the energy you have in better ways. It's a process. I don't have a lot of shortcuts to give to you. It's a process, and sometimes you overreach and sometimes you underreach, but there's a lot more there than we give ourselves credit for. And some of it is, you know, and again, if you're a businessman, an executive, like you say, it's having an athlete's mindset that I've got to distribute my energy, not go all out, you know, on Monday and Tuesday and have nothing left for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So it's learning how to distribute your energy is crucial, and it's relative to your situation. You know, sometimes it's not easy. Sometimes you push the envelope. You know, so I don't know if that answered the question or not. But
no, that was a fantastic answer. I didn't expect you to go there. When you say that you can make someone tired, are you talking specifically about the language that you're using?
Yeah, I can. How do you feel today? And my body language as a coach. Mm. I don't know if this is on videotape, but
it is.
How do I feel right now? Yeah, let's go, you know, or that versus, geez, you know, I didn't sleep. This is me. And I'm talking to you. I didn't sleep, but yeah, come on, we're going to have a really good one today. Well, how do you feel, you know, right now when you, the coach, has this kind of body language and that, you know, you can take the energy out of a room or take the energy away from people in a heartbeat with your words, with your body language, with your actions, you know, and that. Now, I'm not Mr. Pollyanna. I shouldn't use the four-letter word, but you know, I get down. I've had clinical depression, just like a lot of people. Not afraid to talk about that, but I understand this whole thing now. I understand what you need to do and what you don't need to do, you know. And I'm a pretty wired person. I'm a pretty high energy person, you know. But everybody can't be like me either, you know. And I always say the workout starts. Let's say I'm at track or at the pool or with Elise down in Australia. You know, we're going to do a sprint session. She's a cricket player, and I watch the first step they take when they come in the gate. Okay, how do you feel today? Good. Well, really? Do you really feel good? Because your body. I said this to Summer, the swimmer, a few months ago or so ago. I said, this is the first time I've seen you kind of hang your head and your shoulders. Well, I didn't have a very good workout in the water. And I said, well, okay, let's talk about that for a minute. And we did. And I said, okay, so now that put that behind you. That you're a swimmer. That's really important. I understand. But now we're going to do your dry land strength training session. So we're going to cut out this and this and this. And we want high energy and high quality. And all of a sudden, she feels better. She finishes, took a 30-minute workout and made it 20 minutes. And she goes, oh, bingo, comes back next day, everything's good. You know, so that's called coaching. It's called teaching, you know. I was a teacher, classroom teacher. I'd walk into the classroom some days and it wasn't going to happen. You know, so what do you do then? You know, especially when they were 12 years old. You know, you got to pull out deep into the bag of tricks, you know. So anyway. So.
And when you talk about.
You're an energy giver and an energy taker. The worst athlete can be around. And as a coach, you have to be an energy giver. But you take some energy back from the athletes. The hardest athletes to coach are the energy takers. They suck the being out of you, you know, and that. And they're tough. You know, they're tough. And that's where you need outside help, you know, too.
And then what are some specific actions people can take in terms of maybe it's their posture, their physiology, the words they use that can bring energy to themselves and to the room?
Self-talk, monitor your self-talk. That can be huge. Be aware of your posture, you know, when you're interacting with other people, you know, and that, you know, you go, I love to watch people. And up until recently, I spent way too much time in airports watching people. And it's fascinating to watch, you know, just how people, you can almost tell, like, you know, how, you know, I've never, not without talking to them, just watching them. And then tone of voice is huge, you know. Sometimes talk lower tone of voice and then project your voice, you know, and that forces people to pay attention. The best coaches I've ever worked with, a guy named Ken Shields up in Canada, he was a national basketball coach. And the first time I attended his practice, this is the honest, goodness truth. Now, I don't know if you'll be able to hear me. He never talked in a voice. And he would say, okay, Vern, I want you to do this, this, and this. But when his voice went up two octaves, you know, they knew it was even more important. You know, things like that, little things. And I didn't know that when I started coaching at 21. It took years to learn, you know. But those are things as that you as an individual, you know, you're a businessman, and you have control of those things. You know, try to control your environment. You know, and how you dress, how you look, is really important. How you look is really important. What's professional? Well, it's not. I mean, that was what shocked me when I came down here to Florida and I saw all the high school coaches with T-shirts that said "Eat at Joe's Oyster Bar" and all of that. Because where I grew up, and then when I coached in California, we were, you know, Santa Barbara High School year, and you know, and that, and then we're, and I, the, my first mentor, my head coach, we wore a tie for track meets. You know, it projected an image to the youngsters that, you know, this is important, you know, too. So I got way off on a rant there. Sorry.
No, I don't think so. I think that's great. And I think it's just an example of figuring out who you want to be, then dressing as the best version of that. I think it's really good. How do you view sleep when it comes to energy and recovery? What are some of your kind of simple thoughts on that?
Give me some. That's the hardest thing getting older is, you know, and I've been reading up on the physiology of it and aging, and you just don't sleep as long. Ooh. I remember, you know, sleep is really important. If you don't sleep, that's when your body recovers, and that's when all kinds of learning occurs and things like that. We know that. And today, society has so many things that interfere with sleep, you know, the computers, the screens, the music, some of the music, that kind of stuff. It's extremely important, and napping is really important. All the great athletes that have been around knew how to nap. In fact, a lot of the coaches, you know, just a 15, 20 minute nap, find the time. When I was coaching at Cal, I only had one assistant. I used to go down once the weather got okay, and I'd have to start at 12:30. I'd go down at 10 to 12, no cell phones then, and sleep on the pole vault pit for 20 minutes, you know. It was awesome. So, and I mean, when I was young and competing in college, I'd sleep through 11 o'clock classes. I'd go out and lay down on the grass and sleep through the next class, you know, and that. So, no, it's extremely important. We know a lot about it today. And we know about, you know, what's the first thing you do when an interrogation, you know, the dark web, not dark web, but is sleep to just keep people awake, you know, mm-hmm. and people it's. And physiologically what happens. So I think you have to, each person has to find, you know, their routine. There are very, very known things don't do, not to do. But I think each person has to find their routine that works for them. You know, some people like the room warmer. My wife does, 50 some years married. I like the room 67, 68 degrees, mm-hmm. you know. It's physiologically most people respond, you know, to that. So no, it is important. And I ask the athletes that I work with to always record their sleep, hours of sleep, or, you know, or if they had trouble to sleep. And I don't read their training logs. We used to have different forms that I used in pro baseball and pro sports and that. But it was more like it was an entree to a conversation. Well, why aren't you sleeping? Well, you know, we went out and had one too many beers last night. And okay, well, what's the effect of, you know, without laying a guilt trip on them? I mean, they're adults. But okay, well, what does that do? How does that compromise your sleep? You know, yeah, I get it. I mean, even now, if I have a glass of wine after like 7 o'clock, I don't sleep as well. You know, the effect that alcohol has. So. You know, things like that. So it's educating people, educating yourself, so you can counsel people that you're working with.
That's great. And then so much of what we talk about on this show is it's a balance of we want to consistently be spiraling up when it comes to our training, our nutrition, our sleep, and our goals and our who we are as people. But at the same time, there's this other thing of how can we still perform when we don't get a night of sleep or when something happens in life that's just, you know, life happens. Do you have any specific tools that you feel in terms of maybe daily practices or mental training that people let's say you don't get a good night of sleep. Let's say you're going through, you know, divorce or something like that, where you can still show up as your best.
You can't just show up. You have to be there. And that's the first thing we talk about. You can show up. I can be a shell. So what are the tools we use to make sure you're there? And so some of that is you start workout, you start practice I always get there early, want to talk to them, in this case, that most of the people I work with in swing are teenagers. You know, we talk about that. Midterms, are you getting sleep? Well, up all night last night. Well, then we better make some adjustments, okay, in what we're going to do. And seldom will I just say, and look, I coached at Stanford, I coached at Cal Berkeley, you know, two great academic schools, and with high achievers, both athletically and academically. And I learned that, or that was in the 70s. You know, I learned that early on, and that we have to help them develop coping mechanisms and routines. Okay, so you had a bad night's sleep. The meets, it's Saturday, it's that was Friday night. We have a meet today. And this is why I'm not a big fan of a lot of these sleep monitors. I have an Apple Watch, but I don't wear it at night. And I don't want to know. But I have a training log here, and I have a box full of training logs that I've kept since I was 15 and had trouble sleeping. Okay. Some of the best performances I've had, some of the best workouts I've had, and I've athletes had after when they came to the track or they came to the pool. Or in my case, I went to the track, and I just go, this is all, I don't know what's going to happen today. Warmed up, and bingo, man, it's like a light went on. You know, so now you crash after the mm-hmm. the adrenal system and that, you know, really, yeah, so you have to recognize that. But a lot of times, and this is what's wrong with a lot of these sleep monitors. First of all, they're bogus. I mean, there's a lot of pseudoscience that's there, and I won't mention names, but I had a young man at, I won't say even what university, because they're not, that he refused to wear it. I held him in his arms when he was a little baby. He's an All-American swimmer, captain of the team. Mm. He said, what happens if I wake up on Saturday of the SEC championships and it tells me I'm not ready? Well, a great question. What do you do? I gotta warm up. I gotta tow the blocks, and I gotta swim. You know, So it's all about self monitoring, learning yourself. You know, learning what of your environment you can control, what you can't control. You know, all of those kinds of things. How do you react to various situations? Like when I travel, sometimes. I mean, I've had a roommate for 55 years, right? And she's a night owl. I'm a morning person. So right away, she comes to bed late and that. But if I go on the road and we're at, it's really hard for me now to room with somebody, you know? So you got to know that. And, you know, and now it's hard if you're a college coach or something, but if you're a businessman, you know, and your company wants to cut costs and you're on a trip and two people are rooming together and the other person snores all night, you know, what do you do? You know, so, I mean, I just try to get single rooms myself, but, if I can, yeah. And keep the temperature down.
And you mentioned, regardless what happens the night before, the importance of getting into your routine and then accomplishing the task. With the hundreds, if not thousands, of elite professional athletes that you work with, can you talk about how much of a role rituals and routines played with them, portrayed with them in their performance?
Yeah, Rich, I've done some work with preeminent sports psychologists, and this can be a bad thing too, where the ritual, the routine becomes such a rigid ritual that if something happens, and you know, they're upset their routine. And so we'll actually rehearse that sometimes, you know, say, okay, you missed the bus didn't show up. You know, this has happened in the Olympic Games, you know, the bus, or you missed the bus. What are you going to do? You know, things like that. I mean, the greatest, Edwin Moses was one of the greatest track and field athletes of all time, won, I think, 155 straight races in the 400 hurdles, which is a highly tough event.
Yeah.
And I watched him every day. And you didn't need a watch. 3 o'clock, here comes Edwin.
Yeah.
And he'd set up in a corner of the field, and he had a routine that he went through. So in 1984, in the Olympic trials, and it was the Olympic venue, was in the Coliseum, he did the same thing in Olympic trials. And then you could watch him warm up before Olympic Games. Michael Jordan, same thing. You know, he'd wear
a new pair of shoes. Can you give me 1 second here? I need to grab a replacement mic.
And
give me one second.
I was only around him 2 years, and that. But he had a routine, a set routine. Steph Curry, I'd never worked with Steph Curry, but my daughter worked for Rakuten, and they traveled together for his underrated tour, and they were in Japan. And she said, "Dad," she said, "Steph is, he's so dialed in." She said, "You know," he said to her, because she was kind of managing the thing. She said, "Now, Kristen, Japan, I need a gym tomorrow morning at 9. I only need it for 20 minutes, you know, like that." You know, think, but yeah, that's such a characteristic of the special ones, the great athletes. You know, they have a routine. They know their routine. That routine, they monitor it, and that tells them what I have to dial it up or I have to dial it down. You know, I'm overhyped, you know? So then I sat in, the sports psychologist that I worked with got permission for me to sit in, because I wasn't a cert psychologist. I did work with him with the divers at Mission Viejo leading into the 84 Olympics. Sitting, and a lot of people don't even know who Greg Louganis was. Listening to Greg Louganis was an education. It was Sony Walkmans then, you know, not earbuds, right? And he had a selection of songs. If he came to the pool and he felt like he wasn't energized and ready to go, he had a selection of songs that he played. Or if he was overhyped, he had a different selection of songs. And I think, man, that's primo right there. You know, that's... And so I've shared that with a lot of athletes too, a lot of younger athletes, you know. I ask them a lot of times, what do you listen to? You know, now they don't like the music that I listen to, but, you know, Elise Perry, the cricket player that I work with, I've been working with her for about 18 months, and I actually suggested some old-fashioned Birth of a Beat by Sandy Nelson. It's heavy percussion in that, to listen to that before she bowled, because there was a rhythm, and I'm a big believer in rhythm and tempo, and coach rhythm and tempo in everything I do, you know. But music is an entree to the brain and to the soul.
And then staying with this idea of routines, I love what you were saying in terms of the importance of rhythm and tempo. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit more on that in terms of what that looks like in sport, and then also maybe how that can be applied outside of sport?
Sure. I mean, think about it. As human beings, we have a basic rhythm. It's called our heartbeat. Why do they put the newborn baby, obviously, at the mother's breast, but on her chest? And you see that. I saw that look with my granddaughter. I saw it with my kids, you know, when we'd hold them, you know, and that. And so it's either, you know, you have 60 beats, 50 beats, whatever, something like that. But if you, I've seen certain videos like this where the sound was off, and it was a runner, it was a jumper, it was a baseball pitcher, a baseball hitter, and it was tuned to music, and it's beautiful. There's a rhythm. You can hear a great run. You can hear a great throw, and I was telling this story to somebody the other day. I said that German team, Bayer Leverkusen, used to come to California to train. And this is when I really picked up on it. I was early 20s and third or fourth year coaching at a long jumper. And I didn't understand German, but I didn't need to understand German, because the jumper would jump and he'd come back over and the coach would go. And he'd go back and you'd see him count, you know, like that. And so if you hung out with me working with an athlete, like the other day with Summer, we do a fellow to swing squat. And one of the biggest things that's going to be a difference maker for her is the ability to change tempos in the middle of a race. So you have X number of strokes and that. And we know the opposition, and you don't set the race to the opposition. You focus on your strengths. But I said, okay, we're doing 8 reps. I want 4 I want 4. And I want the next 4 like that. So what? Speed it up. And so you feel the rhythm and tempo. And this is where I think people are really missing the boat in a lot of strength training stuff, a lot of the exercise. We do a lot of, unilateral stuff, things like that, stuff with a bar, but it's not bar speed. It's the rhythm, and you tune in. The more the athlete can, it sounds airy-fairy, but the more the athlete can understand that aspect of it, look, I started working with Elise when she was 31 years old, and she started playing international soccer too. She's a great athlete. I played in the World Cup, but cricket at age 15. So she was at a sticking point, and that's one of the biggest things we've changed, is getting her tuned into the various rhythms of the sprint, the jump, the hit, things like that. It's takes a lot of work. It's you and the athlete really working together to understand that. Music is part of it, but just getting a feeling of internal rhythms and that,
I know the Soviets were big in track. The Soviets were big in terms of drums and or what you're talking about in terms of when they train sprinters. Do you feel like the athlete resonates more with that, or is it what you're talking about, it's more of a feeling?
Going to Jamaica, I was fortunate for 4 or 5 years to work down go down 3 weeks at a time to Trinidad, work with various sports, and with that, yeah, I mean, the steel drop, and that, I mean, you just feel it, it's music is a big part of it, the selection of music, very percussive rhythmic types of things can really help you key in on the rhythm, too.
And then to go back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of energy management, it sounds like music potentially can be a tool that can be used to increase energy or decrease energy.
Yeah. And when I was in grad school at Stanford, I don't know if they still have it, they had a graduate dance program, and then we had classes together. And that's what opened my eyes, because I was really too mechanical in everything that I did. And having some classes together, not movement classes, but talking to them about it, I just go, wait a minute, you're missing a whole element. And just being able to dance, all that stuff is really important. But what I see happening with a lot of things today is we're creating robots. We're trying to fit people into a box, this is correct technique for the high jumper. This is correct technique for a pitcher. And if you don't do that, yet some of the greatest people in those events are outside, on the periphery of that perfect technique. So it's what's perfect for you that enables you to impart the force into the ground or into the implement or whatever, hang out with dancers and that. There's a terrific thing on public television with Twyla Tharp, who's my age and older. Twyla Tharp and Missy Copeland. Missy Copeland was interviewing her. And it was, what an eye-opener. And they showed clips. And I recommend everybody read Twyla Tharp's book. It really makes you think. She's my age, and I think older. I think closer to 80. And she gets up every morning at 5:30 and goes to the gym and does, a vigorous workout. But she moves with such grace and rhythm, and that. And And they talked about how do you express yourself through movement? I mean, that's what athletes do. We're expressing ourselves through movement, you know, and it's fun to watch. That's why, like, somebody like Patrick Mahomes is really fun to watch. He gets it, you know. It doesn't always look like the textbooks say you should throw the ball, but he gets the ball to the receiver at the right time in the right place, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes it's underhand, sometimes, you know, and stuff like that. I don't know. I mean, he grew up, you know, with a rich, varied sports background. So maybe that's part of it, you know, so, yeah.
And then you mentioned weights and how things like, of course, there's a time and a place for like bar speed, right? Velocity. But what did you mean by tempo when it comes to weights?
Well, like, for example, one of my cornerstone principles in terms of strength training is body weight before external resistance. I'm just working on that chapter right now. Through a full range of motion that you can control, the appropriate rhythm and tempo. So one of the things that I want to see is, if I say she came and said, Vern, I want to do some leg stuff with you. Can you do 20 body weight squats breaking parallel in 20 seconds? That's fast. That's fast eccentric. Okay. Really? And that's where you start. That's what you build on. I don't need a gym aware or some technique to learn that. My eyes will tell me, you know. Now, there's certain things that I do want to measure. I want to get accurate measurements on, but I want to feel, because understanding what one per second is, it's not as easy as it sounds, you know. So it's coaching people through that and working on that. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, it sure does. And then if someone wanted to try that experiment with what you just said, what are some things they could do to do their squats at body weight faster? Or is it just reps, practicing them?
You have to think like you're dropping each time. I don't like to do bench squats or anything like that, but I try to put something so they have to touch their butt to it, you know, adjust the depth, you know, so they feel it, not sit on it, but touch it, you know, and then can you completely extend? And I'll show them hands behind your head, can't use your arms. So you got to really focus in on your trunk and your your legs. And then do you get full extension? I want to see your chest. You know, you talk them through it, you know, and that. And you don't start, I don't start with 20 reps in 20 seconds. You usually start with five seconds, 10 seconds, something like that, you know, but that's a cornerstone. And see, and that's what we build upon. So now let's use squatting as an example. So do I do external load squats? Absolutely. But what, so my first progression is, how much weight do we add? Well, I'll add a weight vest, which I perceive as internal, you know, internal load. Then I might add a weight vest and a sandbag. And I've learned that I can get up really good athletes progressing through this program can get up to about, usually men about 50% of body weight and women for 40, but it's getting closer and closer now, where they can do their sets at one per second with 40 to 50% of body weight. Then we'll shift to external load if necessary. But some sports, it's not necessary. Okay. It's necessary if I'm a lineman in football and I have to move somebody, or I'm a shot putter, you know, and that. So that idea of, and I don't call it speed, I call it tempo. You know, you can use a metronome to help them understand it, you know. Boy, let me tell you, 5 sets of 20 body weight squats first, with 1 minute between, you're so sore you can't walk out of the gym. That's not the point. It's fast eccentric, okay? And then we'll work it down, lower reps, you know, that kind of stuff. But again, it's based on a progression through percentage of body weight. And that's one of the biggest things that I see that I criticize today in a lot of strength and power training programs. You can't identify a clear progression. You know, what's a progression? How do you progress? We don't do a lot of work, power cleaves with Olympic bars, that kind of stuff. we do tremendous tonnage with dumbbells and kettlebells and that kind of stuff, you know, pulling movements and diagonal patterns and that kind of stuff, you know, to that's the way the body works, you know, instead of being locked into a bar. So
I think that's really good. No, not at all. I think it's really good that the power of progression. And again, going back to what we're talking about in terms of energy management, when you were when you were talking about how when you were working 14, 16 hours a day and people asked if you were tired, you said, oh, well, I had energy. And it sounds like one of the reasons you had energy is you were noticing progress in yourself and noticing progress in your students.
Exactly. And that's what befuddled me early on and with my own training, like, God, I can lift a ton. I'm doing all, even with some of the running and jumping. Wait a minute, Vern, you're doing too much. You come out every day and your legs are dead. How can you jump? You got to look at, hey, what's a hard day? What's an easy day? It's hard for athletes. It's hard for me now. It's hard for me to take a day off. Mm-hmm. You know, I have one of my former beach volleyball players and her sister-in-law work out, great lady. And we just only did 25 minutes this morning, you know, that was awesome. When I wrote in my training log over here, but first I go, oh, but we didn't go 40 minutes. You know what? I felt great.
Mm.
And that's, isn't that what it's about? You know, and I do the same thing if I were an athlete, you know, I think sometimes we have a tendency to, sometimes, you know, no pain, no gain, right? It's, you know, if I don't leave with a gallon of sweat on the floor in the weight room, I haven't done a workout. Wait a minute. Live to fight again, you know, mm-hmm. too. So sometimes you have to push the envelope. I get it, you know, but if you're trying to do that every day, you're setting yourself up for, you know, a great fall is what happens, you know, so.
Yeah. And then you wrote an entire book on medicine ball training. I've for a long time have been a huge advocate of that. Is that something that you're still a huge advocate of? And can you talk a little bit about the benefits of the med ball?
Every day, medicine ball, different weight medicine balls, mostly not football players a little heavier, but most, yeah. All kinds of patterns with medicine balls, throws, jump throw with a medicine ball. You know, the fact that medicine balls 30 years ago, you know, the Europeans had rubber medicine balls that bounced. We didn't, or they were leather, and you have to buy new medicine balls every 3 months. And the fact that they bounce, you can do wall throws, you know, imitation throws. No, I'm as big an advocate of that methodology now, maybe even in some respects bigger. You know, it's the efficacy of it is beyond reproach. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And here's the thing too. I'll say something with the throws. See, I see a lot of things. I don't hang out on Instagram or TikTok. I don't even know what TikTok is really, but Instagram I was introduced to. And I see people, they throw the med ball. That's great. How about catching the med ball? See, that's course reaction. So we have a wall throw series that's 120 throws and catches. Because every time I catch, I've got a rebound, and that's the force reduction phase. And this is one of the reasons why a lot of baseball players today have, and pitchers and hitters have, intercostal muscle pulls because they throw the med ball, but they don't. It's the catching that is a deceleration mechanism that also helps with postural integrity. That is really important. So yeah.
And then in your experience over the past 50 years, what do you feel like has changed? That what immediately comes to mind in terms of the coaching industry and the training industry, what you've seen? Is there anything that stands out?
Well, we know now as a research and practice in that why certain things work. But we're still, so that's, I think that helps a lot. So there's certain things that I knew worked 50 years ago, but I didn't have validation for it. And I do have scientific validation in terms of biomechanics you know, physiology, psychology, all of that. So that's one thing that I think has, but I still see people doing stupid stuff that we know is not, it's just not going to be productive. And people trying to do more, where we've learned that, you know, being on point, Chase, if I'm working with you, here's what's optimum. We're still chasing maximum too much, you know, as opposed to optimum. That would be one thing. And I think the other thing that I've seen change that bothers me is misinformation and pseudoscience, you know, across the spectrum, whether it's supplements, whether it's exercises, whether it's training programs and that kind of stuff. Because to me, there's still a profound lack of understanding of progression. Okay, progression, and making and in the sports world where you have a team, the inability to individualize is just defies me. You know, how people say, well, I've got 40 athletes, I have 100 athletes. Yeah, okay. You ever heard of grouping? You know, there's a lot of ways to address this. You know, and I just don't think we're doing a good job of it, despite what we know. So, and I don't. I'm not saying I have all the answers. I don't want to come across. That's not me. I have all the questions. I have a lot more questions. But you asked for the observations of what I'm seeing. And it's not just my opinion. Some of my colleagues, some of my game colleagues, really close friends that are coaches feel the same way.
Yeah. Evan, same question for talent development with youth. What do you feel like is gotten better over the past 50 years, and what do you feel like has gotten worse?
Well, we're trying to find the next Tiger Woods right away. And there's one Tiger Woods. You know, you look at the thing when he was on Johnny Carson and that kind of stuff. And it's really hard to predict in a prepubescent child future athletic success. Now, once they get through puberty and that, the odds are a little bit better, you know. But it's, I know one of the things you sent me, I believe in multilateral development. Learn as rich a repertoire of movement skills as you can before you specialize in one particular movement, okay? And free play is crucial. Now, you're going to see kids, and you're going to see kids at 7, 8, 9 that they catch your eye. And a lot of times, some of those move on. I had a 7th grade gym class at LaCoomber Junior High that had Terry Schroeder in the class, who went on to be the greatest water polo player ever. He's considered the 5-hole. And I had a guy get in that class named Jesse Orozco, who pitched in the big leagues until he was 46 years old. I had five kids in that class, so they're 12 years old, five kids in that class who went on to be collegiate All-Americans in track and field. Now, did we know? Certainly with Jesse Orozco, no, because he grew in his senior year in high school and went to junior college. With Terry Schroeder, he was the best, he was the most coordinated kid in the class. He was a shortstop, he was a quarterback, he was a point guard. And he didn't touch a water polo ball till he was 15 years old and a swimmer. So I always hearken back to that. Karch Kurai is the opposite. Karch Kurai, acknowledged as one of the greatest volleyball players of all time, gold medalist indoors and on the beach. He's a national coach now. I saw Karch Kurai play with his dad when he was 6 years old on the beach, and you go, that kid's going to be really good. He just and he did. He just kept playing and he kept getting better. You know, so. But sometimes you just don't know. You just don't know. You know, they get kids. I don't know this is true, but I've been told the story that Scottie Pippen was grew like 6 inches after a stretch. You know, so all of he had basketball skills, but he wasn't. He was 6 feet or something. You know, and so it's. I think this idea of trying to predict and identify future athletic success is futile. We should get back to mandatory physical education in the schools. Kids playing multiple sports, I think, is really important. Really important, you know. So Summer, who's the world record holder, she's 17, but she didn't like figure skating. Her sister's a world class figure skater, and she told me today, I think I was better than my sister. Now that's her. But she did a lot of stuff. She didn't really specialize in swimming until she was about 12 and a half, 13. Mm-hmm. You know, Elise Perry, who's the greatest female cricket player ever, is a world class soccer player. And she said, I played my, she had a, I don't know if her brother's older, younger, but she said, we play until it was dark, you know, and outside, play every game you could imagine, you know. And so, I mean, those are, I can tell story after story after story like that. And there's exceptions. Tiger Woods is an exception. The kid, he's 23 years old now, is the world record holder in the pole vault. Started pole, his dad was a pole vaulter. His mother was a heptathlete. Started pole vaulting when he was 5 years old, but he did everything else, you know, too. He didn't specialize in pole vault until after high school. And he's, you know, so I don't know if to me, the message is really clear, but we have to recognize, Chase, that youth sports are a multi-billion dollar industry. So, you know, I had my son was not an athlete. He could have been. He didn't. He's more into theater arts and art and stuff like that. My daughter was a really good athlete, and she still holds the county record here in the sprints. And she made the choice after junior in high school to specialize in soccer. But before that, she did soccer and track and field and danced, you know, and that, and then ended up, after playing two seasons of college soccer, I don't like it, and went back to track. You know, and she was good, not great, but good. It was a great experience for her, you know. So everybody's not going to be an Olympian. Everybody's not going to be a world record holder. And if you look at these programs around the world, you know, it's more the outlier that ends up making it than somebody that was identified, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so do as many different movements as possible. And you would say that's up until the age of 12, 13, 14?
Well, it's more convenient to put an age, but, you know, I mean, you can have a 12-year-old who biologically is 9 or who's 16. Sure. Best player on my junior high basketball team, you know, been shaving for 3 years, you know, and at ninth grade, you know. So, yeah, but, I'd say through middle school or junior high school, something like that, you know, where you're getting them as rich and varied a movement experience as possible. And they're active, you know, so, yeah.
And then do you have very much experience with basketball?
I love basketball. But 5'11 centers didn't go very far in basketball. I used to jump center. That tells you. I love basketball. I've worked with basketball at all levels, coached junior high basketball. During the summer, that's when I started coaching. My high school basketball coach was a huge influence, and I would go back and help him coach summer league basketball when I was in college. And then got to obviously 2 years with the Bulls, but I worked with the Canadian men's national team from 1988 to 94, and the women's team just 92 to 94. You know, so I've done a lot with basketball. I really enjoy basketball.
If you look at one thing, they're all big, but many of the best players in the National Basketball Association now are international. Do you feel like that is just because of these guys' size and the combination in size and skill, or do you feel like in terms of development that's happening over in the United States is impacting that as well?
We play too many games, and we don't teach fundamentals. Ron Adams, who's assistant coach for the Warriors, who I know quite well now, is my age, and we talk all the time. And I watched their game last night. They have a Brazilian, they have they have three or four foreign players. First of all, like the Serbians and Croatians and that, American coaches used to go over there in the 50s and 60s, but the coaches there, here a kid walks in the gym and he's 6'5", he's immediately going to be a post player. And they made them basketball players. They have to shoot, they have to outside shoot, they have to dribble, they have to do everything. We've seen a fundamental an erosion of fundamentals in basketball. I used to like to watch women's basketball. It's terrible now. Fundamentals of, you know, just a 2-foot jump stop, basic things that you need to do. The Europeans still emphasize that. We have not, to the exclusion of being on an AAU team, you know, and playing 5 games a weekend instead of first of all just playing pickup basketball, you know, instinctively learning the game and that too. Yeah.
That's where I was going to go with next is where do you feel is the balance? We're just using basketball as a conduit here, but the balance between, you know, formal games, let's say as a high school AAU team with fundamentals, with free play, where it's the athlete on their own.
Well, I'm a big fan of playing on the playground and 2-on-2, 3-on-3. You know, you play till you lose, so you learn about pressure and that, and working on the fundamentals. I don't want to speak out of turn, but I know a lot of basketball people, and what happens with these AAU travel teams, they just cherry pick the best people. They never play together, and then there's enough balls for them, you know, that like I get the ball, I shoot, and so you see really poor fundamentals. And the same thing's happening in soccer. Think about your 5th game on a weekend. How do you feel? You know, where's your skill now? You know, it's survival of the, I don't know, the fittest. It's just, yeah. So, it hurts me to see, because I had a great experience, best athletic experience in my life playing high school basketball with my coach. Kids don't even play for their high schools anymore. You know, and I'd like to see sport, instead of being clubs and outside things, come back to the high school. But that means you have to have trained coaches and PE teachers, which we don't. So that's a whole topic for another time, you know. But no, I think that, I don't know how it's going to change. I'm not trying to be pessimistic. I just don't know how it's going to change, you know, given the parameters and the money involved and shoe companies and all of that.
Well, I guess from an individual's perspective of the parent, it would be to be more considerate of that dynamic, it sounds like, in terms of fundamentals, free play where the kid's leading, and then of course formal play as well. Would you agree?
I think so. Yeah. You don't need a former NBA player working with your 8-year-old. Get a good PE teacher, somebody, you know, who can, and just show them a few fundamentals and let them play a little bit. The next week, a few more fundamentals, let them play, you know, and that kind of stuff. And design soccer too. Design game types of situations where there's constraints, where they have to, okay, we're going to play 3-on-3. You can only use your left hand. We have to shoot. Like my high school basketball coach made us every day, we have to shoot layups left-handed, you know, part of the layup routine, you know, of Pete Carroll, who's not the Pete Carroll who was football coach, but it was deceased now, former, very successful basketball coach at Princeton. They shot layups 20 minutes a day, all different positions, because that's a fundamental. I watched the Warriors game last night against Brooklyn. Both teams missed, within an 8-minute period, missed 3 layups. Come on, you guys. Shit, you're getting $80 million a year. You could at least make a layup. I mean, I contest, you know, virtually uncontested. Sorry, I got to shut up. I'll get,
And you mentioned the word pressure. Of course, you're not a sports psychologist, but in your experience, are there any specific tools that come to mind that athletes and high performers can apply to do well under pressure?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at, in a team sport, everybody thinks they're looking at you and there's 5 other players or 10 other players and that kind of stuff. That's the biggest thing. Most pressure is self-imposed. you know, perceived rather than actual. Now, Summer McIntosh has pressure right now. She's a Canadian. She has potentially the potential to win 3 or 4 gold medals, you know, but she pressures power. The goalkeeper on the 2018 World Cup ice hockey team that I helped Jimmy Radcliffe with as a conditioning coach, she said pressure is power. And there's all kinds of things like that. So it's how you internalize it, how you use it. I mean, my daughter loved pressure. She scored 3 state championship winning goals. And there's a girl that everybody said is going to be the next Mia Hamm. And there's a foul. It's in the high school playoff game. And she went to Kristen and says, "You take the PK." She couldn't handle the pressure, you know, that she imposed on herself. Kristen loved it, you know, and that's what I love. I love being in pressure situations. I want to work with Summer McIntosh. I want to work with Elise Perry. I've waited 55 years to work with the best athletes in the world. I have worked with some of the best. I'm not trying to say that to brag, but, you know, they love pressure. Michael Jordan loved pressure. Sam Cunningham, the first athlete I worked with, best athlete I've ever worked with, won the state championship in the shot put first year, his senior year. There's 3 lead up, the 3 lead up meets and the state meet. He won them all by a total of about 4 inches. He was behind after 3 puts each time. And he was player of the game in the Rose Bowl, things like that. You know, when the game was on the line, give the ball to Sam, you know, right? And can you teach that? That's the question. Yep.
That's what I was going to ask next. Yeah.
You can, to a certain extent. I do think that there's that DNA that's there that you need, you know. Some people just run from it. And, you know, I think you can improve ability to handle pressure, but I don't think you can go from black to white. I just have seen too many, you know, so, yeah, that's my opinion. And it's my opinion, informed some by sports psych and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it is partially genetic, but I think more people need to understand that when our body goes into the kind of that pressure mode, that additional energy, it's the body's designed to perform at a higher level.
Yeah. Stress is life, Tom Stelius, you know, stress is life. And so you inoculate them, you put them, you find different situations to put people in pressure situations. That's what my high school basketball coach did a magnificent job of. You know, he would take somebody who was a poor free throw shooter, we'd be scrimmaging, and he'd blow the whistle, okay, to the line, you know, game's on the line, you know, and that. And we played, we scrimmaged 3 minutes every day, every practice at the end, scoreboard and that, and kept track of results. You know, Dean Smith, who was Michael Jordan's college coach, everything they did in practice was recorded. And you came out of your shower in the locker room and you looked, and you'd look down and you'd say, "Michael Jordan, 14. And he hated that. He told me that, you know, I want to be top of the, so if you, they, you know, like that. So yeah, you put people under pressure and see how they respond, and, you know, and be careful. You gotta be careful. You don't screw with somebody's head, but you know what I'm saying? Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. You want to improve under pressure, then spend more time in pressure situations, specifically in like a training environment. And then what you mentioned with Dean Smith and Michael Jordan at University of North Carolina, it makes me think of this idea of competition. We had 2-time New York Times bestselling author on a couple weeks ago, Ashley Merriman, who wrote a great book called Top Dog, The Science of Losing, which is really all about, yeah, she's amazing. It just so wise. And she, one of the questions I asked her was, you know, should more people be competing? Not necessarily in sports, but, you know, in just throughout their life. And she said, yes, as long as the focus is on improvement rather than winning or losing. Because she says that science says that's the biggest benefit to competition, because it leads to more improvement than non-competition. Do you feel like there people should be competing more? And how do you kind of view competitiveness?
If you understand competition, so the derivative of the word the origin of the word competition is competere, which means strive together with. But we have this notion that it's, so we're, you know, it's fighting. We're you know, and I saw this even when I was in college. Good teams, really good teams playing against crappy teams play crappy. And so that strive together, you know, compete. I got to beat myself first. If it is to be, it's up to me, you know? So no, there's nothing wrong with competition. It's in fact, we're hurting kids by not letting them be in more competitive environments, I think, in my opinion. So yeah, it's natural. I mean, remember, it's strive together with. If I want to be better, I know I have various people in my field that I don't necessarily admire. I'm not a businessman, but I want to be better than those people. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to fight against them. Find out what they do, and then can I do it better? You know, within the context of my strengths and my weaknesses, you know, so yeah.
Having that level of awareness is just something that's so critical that we keep going back to on this show. Okay, as we almost wrap this up here, Vern, I'm sure you've heard of the idea of like marginal gains and 1% better in terms of pro sports and elite athletes, and it's kind of gone into the rest of the world of high performers as well. But my question is, while so many people are looking for that, those marginal gains, do you feel like what one or two things maybe are like just huge, like 30% things that you feel like people potentially are missing in the search for?
Yeah, people are running around all over in business. That's become the big thing. Mm-hmm. So look, if you don't get the first 98% right, you can spend all day looking for 2%. That's the first thing. And I abhor the term marginal gains. I can't stand it. I won't use it. I'm going to answer your question, but I will only say it because you asked me to. So, okay. But what I'm looking for with me right now as a coach, what's my winning point of difference? What's my winning point of difference? What am I doing today that's going to make me a better coach? If I said that to Summer, I say that to Elise, I say that, what's your winning point of difference? Not and globally, yes, but what are you doing today? Okay. What are you doing today that's going to be a winning point of difference in the competition or when I have to go out and consult with a team in India that I'm going to, you know, or something like that. And so, that's how I express it. And you can say, well, that's marginal gains. Well, sometimes it's big gains, but it's day to day. See, I think that's what we forget. And too many people in searching for marginal gains are looking for magic bullets. You see? Mm-hmm. And I think winning point of difference, and I got that idea, an amazing guy, his name is Phil King. Phil is background is aquatics. He became very wealthy, independently wealthy, doing swim schools in Australia. But more importantly, he had no knowledge of track and field. His wife was a 400 hurdler, and she won the gold medal in Seoul, Korea in 1988 by the smallest margin anybody's ever won that race. Mm. And his thing, that I got this idea of winning point of difference. I remember when I first met him, he brought me in to work with another one of his athletes. And he sat me down. We were talking. He's a little younger than me. And he goes, well, what are your winning points of difference? And I go, well, what do you mean? He said, well, what makes you good enough that I want to bring you in to Australia to work with, you know, whatever, for his athlete? And I go, wow, yeah, that's interesting. Never talked about marginal gains, you know. So, I mean, yeah, you sleep on a better bed. Like, that's common sense. Mm-hmm. Shit, I mean, you know, come on, don't they make so much of that? And these people that are preaching marginal gains in sport, a lot of times, we know that the marginal gain was medicinal, you know. Mm-hmm. So they push. When I hear people talk about some of the stuff that these marginal gains people talk about, they're in the gray area in terms of, medicinal, I call them medicinal aids, you know, too. So, you know, what am I doing day by day in the workout? What's the opportunity that you have today in today's workout to define a winning point of difference? Summer's going to, I think, race Katie Ledecky Thursday, and her and the other coach, and we had a conversation with her. What are you going to do the next 2 days that's going to be the winning point of difference? You know, I'll rest my case with that.
That's so good.
Pretty adamant.
Vern, I'd love to end with some rapid fire here. Biggest mentor in your life?
Well, I have to say my high school basketball coach, aside from my parents. Yeah. The high school, he's a history teacher. I became a history teacher too. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Best book or research paper that you've read in the last year?
In the last year?
Yeah.
Jeez, I have to look at. Well, I'm a big friend of Adam Grant. Not the newest, I can't think of the name of it. Not the book just before the newest book, Rethinking by Adam Grant. I keep coming to that. Yeah, I really like Adam Grant in terms of not fiction or something like that. In terms of training, there haven't been as many books come out. I'm finding myself in terms of training going back and looking at a lot of really, really good research from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you know, on that. So, yeah.
And then biggest habit you have added or taken away from your life that has, in the last year, that has had the biggest impact?
That's a good one. Well, it's going to sound funny, but just be present, be fully present. So if I'm talking to you, I'm conscious. The phone just rang here from an athlete I started working with when he's 16 and he's a very successful coach. So I could be distracted, right? Be present. I'm focusing on what we're talking about. Secondly, listen more, talk less. Now I've talked for an hour or something, but listen more, talk less.
That's the
talk less and say more. Yeah, those are. So that's all, to me, that's all wrapped up in one thing. Yeah.
And then last question for one of our listeners who is really struggling right now with adversity, whether that's with their business, whether that's with their life, whether that's with their competition in sport, what would you say in terms of like one sentence that potentially could help them in terms of dealing with adversity and challenges?
Yeah. Well, first of all, know yourself and be you. Don't try to be somebody else, and other, you know, and the common thing is people say, well, you know, go talk to so-and-so, they just went through a divorce. No, be you. Know yourself, know your situation, and be authentic with yourself, be honest with yourself.
That's awesome. Vern Gambata, a wealth of wisdom. Thank you so much for coming on Super Athlete Radio. I know people can find a ton of books of yours on Amazon. And are you on social media? Do you engage with people on social media? Or do you recommend people that want? Okay.
I guess it's called X now. Yeah.
Yes, I saw your X stuff. Yeah.
I'm under on Facebook. It's Vern Gambetta. And on X, it's LinkedIn, which I'm using more and more. And on X, it's at Coach Gambetta. And then the website that you can find Gambetta.com, we're actually moving away from that to the game, G-A-I-N, and then the second end, network.com. And we do, we're going to be doing coaching by design workshops this year in out in L.A. and one in Westchester and then one in Melbourne, Australia in November. And you can find out information about those. We'll have some of the best people in the world there. It's a Saturday, half day, Sunday. And then every other year, we do the Gain Annual, which we do in 2025, which is a week long intensive. If you don't want to sleep, you don't have to sleep. Among the best people in the world, it's just networking. And that's where my focus is on the Gain Network. So
And where's the next Dane Annual going to be, location-wise?
Well, we're not sure. We used to have it at Rice University. We're having our first, but we probably will still go back there because everybody lives in a dorm. Everybody eats together. It's a total immersive experience, you know. Mm-hmm. And the coaching by design workshops are it's not going to be everybody sits and looks at slides. So we might do that for 20 minutes and then have Jim Radcliffe from University of Oregon or, you know, different really top-notch people will go through hands-on and do stuff, you know. So it's really high level, very, very high level. And we set a high bar for ourselves in terms of expectations and a high bar for the learners. So it's cool.
Well, you have me intrigued. You have me, not for sure. That sounds amazing. Cool. Vern, well, thank you so much for coming on Super Athlete Radio. Look forward to doing this again, hopefully in person, and wishing you success and happiness when you move across the country.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks, Chase. Appreciate it. Good luck to you.